with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, October 1st, 2025. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Jesse Coburn, reporter at ProPublica, covering housing, transportation, cities, and infrastructure on the Trump administration's assault on public housing. Then, Lieutenant Governor of New York, Antonio Delgado, challenging sitting Governor Kathy Hochul in the 2026 Democratic gubernatorial primary. We'll be here. Also on the program, government shutdown, day one. Republicans immediately run to the microphones to lie as to why the government is shut down. Have no fear, Trump will fund the Argentine bailout and continue his ICE goons operations across the country. Pete Hegseth complains that generals are too fat. And Trump says U.S. cities to become war game sites. Meanwhile, new economic numbers in a surprise to some, I guess. U.S. private payrolls declined precipitously. Trump pulls clown car economist nominee for the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Guy roundly criticized as being unqualified. Of course, the government had shut down, so we won't see any of those statistics. U.S. eases South Korean worker visas rules in wake of its disastrous Hyundai raid. Reagan-appointed federal district judge finds the Trump regime violated the First Amendment in targeting non-citizens over Gaza protests. Very important ruling. Everyone in the country, regardless of their status, is protected by the First Amendment constraints on our government by our Constitution. DOJ using the FACE Act, an act used to protect abortion clinics, to sue pro-Palestinian protesters. Gaza City exodus is overwhelming aid efforts in southern Gaza. And just breaking, the Supreme Court allows Lisa Cook to continue to be a sit on the Fed board, of course, because capital uber ales. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. It is, in the words of Emma Vigeland.
Jump the gun, damn it. Damn it!
It is, in the words of Emma Vigeland.
Bring me on here, Brian. Hello? Oh, I'm on?
Oh, we don't see that thing anymore. We're missing that window. We can't see that window. Yeah, I need that window back.
All right. Well, I'm here.
And you already said your catchphrase that you came up with that has really caught on. Every 6 months, we'll remind people of that bad joke, that full-on dad joke. It's part of my brand now.
Keep going.
Yep.
Keep it going.
We got a lot to talk about. The government is shut down. There were three Democrats, or I should say three who caucus with Democrats, who voted to in favor of ending conversation on the Republican continuing resolution. That was Fetterman, surprise, surprise, Angus King, who also voted in that way in March, and Catherine Cortez Masto in Nevada. It is really important that you call your Democratic senators and tell them to hold the line, particularly if you are in New Hampshire or in Nevada, because Maggie Hassan is one of those Democrats who voted the last time around. Jackie Rosen also in Nevada. Gallego is also one who needs encouragement.
Kirsten Gillibrand, look at who voted and capitulated to Trump the first time around. I think it was around 10 Democrats, if I remember correctly, in the Senate. They should be prime targets for calls.
The good news is that Gillibrand has I think it is a full weekend junket in a wine cellar in Sonoma Valley.
Hey, wine cave.
Wine cave in Sonoma Valley, forgive me. With, Haley Stevens?
Yes, the AIPAC.
We will win!
So they are going to be rallying in support of wine producers, sommeliers, wine reps, and collectors.
Wine collectors. I mean, we have a big tent in the Democratic Party.
Yes, all of those. Sommeliers, wine representatives, wine collectors and wine producers. There's room for all of them in the
Tuscan
Democratic
inspired spa.
Exactly.
Which is weird.
That's
but,
right.
But if
cold
you're,
plunges.
Yeah, pro Palestine, obviously you're not in the tent. But it's a big tent. It's a big tent.
It's a big tent. All right. But let's get to some of the Republican talking points that are being rolled out. Speaker Johnson went out there and it's frustrating to watch the host say, and I saw Caitlin Collins do this as with him as well. They, to their credit, they basically say you're lying. None of what you're saying is true. But then they let him finish his lie. Later in the program, we will specifically address J.D. Vance's lie. But understand, they were always going to lie about something. So it's not like this government shutdown is giving them a unique opportunity to lie. What it is doing is it's giving the Democrats a unique opportunity to press their point, whether it's specifically about this budget or about the Trump administration at large. Understand, we are right at the precipice of the economy going into the crapper. Jobs numbers are down. Inflation is up. That is it's not even a recipe for stagflation. That's almost the definition of stagflation. So there's a big opportunity here for Democrats to come out and, while they're shoving microphones in their faces and carrying it on the news, to carry this message. But here's the Republicans' attempt. And, of course, it's focused on immigrants. That's all they got.
This morning, the Democratic proposal is designed to prevent millions of Americans from losing their health insurance, losing Medicaid coverage, or paying higher health care premiums. Why are you against that?
That's an absurd statement, what you said there. Let's be clear about what happened last
statement.
Night, George. No, George, let me tell you what happened last night. Everybody can go and review the facts for themselves. 44 Senate Democrats voted to reject a clean, nonpartisan, continuing funding resolution to keep the United States government open. The Democrats said instead that they wanted to give health care to illegal aliens instead of keeping critical services provided for the American citizens. That's what happened, plain and simple. Every Democrat in the House, except one, voted against the clean continuing resolution. It was nonpartisan in nature. There are no policy writers on it that Republicans favored. It's exactly what Chuck Schumer and other Democrats voted for in March, but they've changed their tune.
Can you pause it? I'm sorry. That is why it was so essential that Schumer not cave in March. because then he has that talking point there. Why it's important to shut down the government now is because it, a clean continuing resolution, as he's referring to, would be an extension of the already horrific budget that those Democrats agreed upon and caved to earlier this year. It gives them less of a leg to stand on right now when they allowed it to get to the floor and allowed the budget to pass.
It's why that there needs to be more made of the fact that Donald Trump is breaking the law by going around and not funding things that we have appropriated.
Right.
Now, Schumer did mention this when he came out of that meeting yesterday after praising Donald Trump, or 2 days ago. Mentioned that as a pocket rescission and impoundment, which, you know, again, we know what that means because we do that for a living. But normal Americans do not know about the 1974 Impoundment Act. All you need to say is Donald Trump is abusing his authority with tariffs and with spending, and there's no point in us passing a budget if he's going to do that. But you're right.
Been so much stronger if they had all stood in opposition to the horrific budget that strips millions of people they did that in the spring.
Let's just let Mike Johnson grind this out a little more.
Democrats voted for in March. But they've changed their tune. They changed their tune because Chuck Schumer is having political problems right now. That's just a simple fact, and everybody knows that. He's trying to outrun the far-left portion of his base, so he's decided to inflict pain on the American people.
Here are the facts. The proposal does not provide health care for illegal immigrants. Illegal immigrants cannot buy health care under the Affordable Care Act. They cannot receive health care subsidies. No. Illegal immigrants are ineligible for Medicare, Medicaid, and the Children's Health Program. The Democratic bill does not make them eligible.
It does, actually, because what it does is it unwinds the changes that Republicans
put in. We don't need to hear him grind this stuff out anymore. The fact is that this bill only extends Affordable Care Act subsidies, or I should say the one that the Democrats offered, extends Affordable Care Act subsidies and tries to reverse the Medicaid cuts that are coming in 2026. Now, nobody knows, into 2027, nobody is feeling those Medicaid cuts. We're about a month or two away from feeling the exploding premiums in the exchanges. And of course, that goes everywhere else. Everything else they're talking about, the idea that undocumented immigrants have access to health care under either Medicaid or under the Affordable Care Act is not true. We have a law in this country that anybody who shows up in the ER with an emergency situation is treated regardless of their citizenship. But you cannot, as an undocumented immigrant, go in and get health insurance. Now, some states have chosen to expand their coverage, but that is not a function of what the feds are doing.
Right.
That is a function of what they're doing with their own Medicaid programs.
And the ACA, it statutorily explicitly says that if you are undocumented, you are not able to access or buy into the exchanges, even if you were to pay out of pocket. This was in the law. And Biden, towards the end of his lame duck term, allowed for Dreamers, who are a little half a million around Dreamers in this country, who have legal status, expanded the ACA to allow them to buy into it. But the Trump administration have already reversed it by saying that they under HHS, they are not lawfully present. So they've reversed even that. He has no leg to stand on. He's just explicitly lying.
Yeah. And that the Dreamers, to be clear, are here because of prosecutorial discretion, that they do not technically have legal status because it was never codified under Obama or Biden, for that matter, as a statute. They were included as people who, because of the prosecutorial discretion, could qualify as having a legal status. And again, like you say, HHS reversed that. So there's no difference. But here is also two Republicans who are arguing there's no reason for the Democrats to pass a continuing resolution or a budget because the president has shown on multiple occasions he doesn't care what the budget is. He's going to spend the money the way he wants. Here is a quote, and I think this is from Bloomberg. Representative Mike Simpson, Republican of Idaho. I don't think the Democrats want to shut down either. Their concern right now, and it's a legitimate concern, is how can we agree to any deal when our OMB director, Russell Vogt, will just impound the funds, in other words, not spend them, and say we're not going to spend them there. Here is another quote from another Republican, a senior Republican member of the Appropriations Committee. Quote, if you're a Democrat, even just like a mainstream Democrat, your predisposition might be to help negotiate with Republicans on a funding mechanism. Why would you do that if you know whatever you negotiate is going to be subject to the knife pulled out by Russ Vogt? So in other words, and let's be clear, I mean, this is they're talking about the White House and Donald Trump. It's not like Russ Vogt is operating outside of that. They know that there's no point to this. Here is Mick Mulvaney, former chief of staff of Trump, who apparently, because he's out of the business a little bit, he's not as slippery about lying and can't embarrass himself in the same way because he's probably working as a lobbyist somewhere right now. But here he is on News Nation. I don't know who the guy in the middle is, but the other guy is Brian Tyler Cohen.
I see both sides not even agreeing on some of the facts here. You know, the Trump says Democrats want to give health care to illegal immigrants. You have Democrats who say this is about Medicare and Obamacare. If it's not even agreement there, that's where the hesitation I have is. That's where
I would just say, if you are hosting a news show and you have hesitation about the facts, there's an easy way to resolve this. You go to page 51 of the appropriations bill that the Democrats offered, and you will see subtitled, keep going, go down. Subtitle D, Medicaid. You will see there is nothing in there that refers to expansion to undocumented immigrants. Go ahead, go back.
And as we've said before, the undocumented immigrants subsidize our health care because they still pay taxes, but they don't get the benefits.
But regardless, if this guy's just having a question of fact, I have an idea for you. Yeah. Get the effing internet.
I know.
What's your job?
There, that's where the hesitation I have is. That's where I'm concerned that we're going to even see anything.
Mick, would you agree that not a single dime of ACA subsidies goes toward undocumented immigrants?
Would you agree with me that what the big,
I mean,
one
answer
big
the,
beautiful
please,
bill,
answer the question.
Bill
it's not
did.
That hard to just
wait,
answer
no, wait
the question.
A second. Again, listen, we don't do this on this show. I don't know if you've ever been on here before, but we don't talk over. We're not here to yell at each other. I'm not going to do this anymore, Jesse.
Okay.
So,
all
thanks.
Right.
So
all
there
right,
you go.
I
that's
understand.
The answer right there.
No,
can't
listen,
even acknowledge object. Can't even acknowledge
no,
objective.
Brian, Mick responded. Mick responded. Brian responded. Okay,
no, that's not actually
no,
what happened. No,
he rage quit. He's threw his controller at the TV.
Listen, they want to talk about whatever the big beautiful bill did. Whatever the big beautiful bill did, it's not its real name. Whatever that bill did has no nothing to do with this except for the idea of not cutting all of those people on Medicaid. But in terms of like, and those people on Medicaid were never undocumented immigrants. And so they don't want to answer this question because they know that's the case. Now, the government is going to continue to stay shut down. This is probably going to last, I would imagine, weeks. At a minimum. But at one point, people are going to get these huge bills from the ACA in the exchanges, and that's going to cause everybody's premiums to go up.
If Schumer caves and the only, in the end, the only thing he gets are the ACA subsidies and making sure that those healthcare costs don't go up, that is good for Americans. But know that that's what Republicans secretly want.
Of course.
Because they timed the big ugly ass bill to have the Medicaid cuts where you're going to have between 10 to 12 million people uninsured by 2034 because of these cuts. They timed it to hit right after the midterms. But as Sam says, these ACA marketplace costs going up like this in the exchanges, that would be felt immediately.
In a moment, we're going to be talking to Jesse Coburn, reporter of ProPublica, covering housing, and then Antonio Delgado, the lieutenant governor of New York, in a moment. But first, a couple of words from our sponsor today. That sponsor is Babbel. I got to get this back out. Sorry. I really wanted to say this one. Learning a new language opens the door to new friends and new cultures and maybe even a whole new life. For instance, maybe have decided to start learning Spanish because maybe you think like, Mexico's an option.
Claudia Sheinbaum.
Exactly. I mean, and it's just too difficult to learn French Canadian. So
gross.
But I've been listening to my Babbel on the way to work. It is it's actually fun. It's a little awkward because you're walking down the street and you're sort of talking to yourself. But fortunately, in Flatbush, nobody really notices. I will say that it's been very, very helpful. And I just want to say, Medias Rojas, Barrión.
Wow.
Red Sox, sweet. You can start speaking a new language with confidence. See the confidence in which I said that?
Mm-hmm.
Thanks to Babbel's conversation-based technique that quickly teaches you useful words and phrases about the things you actually talk about in the real world. Red Sox did not come up in that. There's over a dozen languages available to learn. You learn them at your own pace. They are brief, like 10 to 15 minute, lessons essentially. And they have, native speakers, saying these things, both male and female. They're handcrafted by over 200 language experts. Like I say, voiced by real native speakers and built with science-backed cognitive tools like spaced repetition and interactive features to fit any learning style. Babbel's tips and tools for learning a new language are approachable and accessible. It's like having a private tutor in your pocket. The interactive dialogue thing they have now is, it's taken me a while to get up there, but you can literally have a conversation with your Spanish, or any language tutor. Super easy to stay engaged in these things. Again, they're only 10 to 15 minutes a day. It's obviously an app, or you can use the website. A study found that using Babbel for 15 hours is equivalent to a full semester at college. Mm. Like to remind my child of that. With over 16 million subscriptions sold, Babbel's 14 award-winning language courses are backed by a 20-day money-back guarantee. So get talking with Babbel. We want you to learn another language. So I'm teaming up with Babbel to give you 55% off subscriptions at Babbel.com/majority. Get 55% off at Babbel.com/majority. That's up to 55% off. It's spelled B-A-B-B-E-L, B-A-B-B-E-L.com/majority, Babbel.com/majority. Rules and restrictions may apply. We'll put the information in the podcast and YouTube description. And folks, as you know, it is October 1st. And you know what that means. It's officially the spooky season. So it's time for you to get ready for Halloween. You're going to decorate your yard if you have one. Skeletons, or you watch an unhealthy number of horror movies. Stock up on candy for the trick-or-treaters. But what about for you? what are you going to be doing when the mayhem starts to go out? Well, Sunset Lake has got you covered. 30% off all of their Sebade gummies with the coupon code JUSTTREATS25. Sunset Lake's Vibe gummies provide a gentle daytime lift with 30 milligram of Sebade and a microdose of 1 milligram THC. My father is now using those to go to bed.
That is,
I hope I'm not speaking out of turn.
Good development.
If you like something with a little more oomph, check out their Delta 9 gummies, which contain 5 milligrams of THC and 50 milligrams of Sebade. Or if you prefer a THC-free experience, they got Sour Bear gummies with 25 milligrams of Sebade, perfect for any time of the day. Of course, I'm always chomping on these Focus gummies. They got Relax gummies. They got a whole array. They have the Good Night gummies with the melatonin. They've got a whole bunch of gummies. And right now, 30% off with the coupon code JUSTTREATS25, as in year 2025. So sunsetlakesebade.com, use the code JUSTTREATS25. You will save 30% on all their gummies for sleep, for focus, for relaxation, for a little bit of fun. Sale ends October 8th at 11:59 p.m. Eastern. See their site for terms and conditions. We'll put that link in the podcast and YouTube descriptions. And as always, Left is Best will get you 20% off at that site as well. Quick break, and then Jesse Coburn. We are back. Sam Seder, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. Joining us now, Jesse Coburn, reporter at ProPublica, covering housing, transportation, cities, and infrastructure. That's a big portfolio, Jesse. And I would imagine most of the news, not great.
Yeah, hasn't been a great news cycle for my beat recently.
But let's talk about specifically in terms of housing and what's been going on at HUD. HUD started off, it seems like, their first agenda was to roll back any actions that they were doing to protect tenants or reverse discrimination. Just fill us in on that, or, you know, maybe even just give us a TikTok through the Trump administration up to this point.
Sure. So Trump nominated Scott Turner to be his HUD secretary. Scott Turner is a deeply conservative Republican from Texas who served in the first Trump administration on his Opportunity Zone Council in the White House. And, you know, they wasted no time kind of implementing his vision for housing policy at HUD, you know, massive layoffs at the agency. Pretty much right away, there are a number of DOGE staffers at HUD who were, you know, implementing lots of reforms right away. The first wing of HUD that really took a hit was the Fair Housing Office. That's the part of HUD that investigates and enforces, you know, housing discrimination and segregation laws. There are really steep cuts there. And,
just to ask you, the Fair Housing, does that cover all housing issues across the board, private and public, or just specifically with any type of public housing or Section 8 housing?
Private and public. So, you know, private landlords discriminating against their tenants, you know, wanting to kick out a tenant because a woman is pregnant and wants to have a kid, or, you know, mortgage lenders who refuse to lend in Black neighborhoods, or, you know, cities that are engaging in wholesale segregationist policies. That's the sort of thing that part of HUD goes after. That work has really kind of ground to a halt under the Trump administration. They've shut down many major investigations into fair housing. I think that office's staff has dropped by half. It's sort of just really gumming up the works of fair housing enforcement. And then on the housing assistance side of things, recently ProPublica obtained two proposals from the Trump administration, still unpublished, to dramatically change public housing, Section 8 housing vouchers, basically the nation's major rental assistance programs that serve, you know, some of the country's poorest residents. By basically what the administration wants to do, we found, was to implement or to allow housing providers to impose pretty harsh work requirements and term limits on receiving that sort of assistance.
And so when we talk about HUD, those are the two functions basically it serves. It's either protecting people's rights in the context of housing or providing some type of housing assistance.
Yeah, I mean, they actually do a lot more than that as well. Those are the main functions. They also give out billions of dollars in grants to communities across the country for community development programs. They actually do a lot of disaster relief stuff, which most people associate with FEMA. HUD does a lot of that as well. Housing finance is housed within HUD as well. So, you know, mortgage policy stuff, that's also happening at HUD.
I mean, I just want to note, just because of the irony of all of this, that Trump back in the 70s was sued by the DOJ for racial discrimination at his own properties. And
he had a consent decree.
Yeah. I mean, this goes back very, very deep into his political history, although the Republicans are all about this generally. But
that's right.
Go ahead,
Sam. All right. Well, let's walk us through. The idea is, how do we kick, I mean, from their perspective, how do we kick as many people out of public housing or public housing support through a Section 8 program? How do we do that as much as possible without explicitly saying we're going to do that? I mean, that's sort of what they did with Medicaid as well. They pretended they're cutting undocumented people from it, and they're just cutting people from it. Walk us through what they are, what those requirements, or I should say, what those levers they're going to use to eliminate people, the help that we give people in terms of housing.
Sure. So HUD has drafted two major rules that it hasn't formally introduced yet, but seems likely that it will, that would just dramatically overhaul how these federal housing assistance programs work. The first rule would allow public housing providers and private landlords that rent to tenants supported by things like Section 8 housing vouchers to require those tenants to work in order to continue to live in that federally assisted housing. It would allow those housing providers to kick those tenants out after 2 years. If you live in public housing, you've been living there for 30 years, you might have to leave 2 years from now, and you might have to work full time in those intervening 2 years.
Okay, wait a second. So those are two separate requirements, right? You're saying you're only limited to public housing for 2 years,
mm-hmm.
which is, I mean, anybody who's moved knows, like, there's a cost associated with that, not to mention that there's no guarantee that you're going to be able to afford other housing. So these are two separate requirements. One is the automatic kick out after 2 years, and then the other is the work requirements. Let's take the work requirements. A landlord who's getting Section 8 vouchers can be in charge of assessing whether you are working or not. Yep. And that sounds like one of the most effed up things I've ever heard. Aside from, and we'll get into sort of the generic implications of so-called work requirements, but is this every member of a household? Is it just one member of a household? How does it work?
So the work requirements would apply to quote unquote work eligible adults. So basically, if you're elderly or disabled, you wouldn't know a housing provider could require this of you. And there are other smaller carve outs. If you're pregnant, if you're a college student, this couldn't apply to you. But for pretty much every other work eligible adult, and that includes, parents of children. So if you have a child ages 7 or older, this could apply to you.
Aren't we supposed to be encouraging stay at home moms?
Yeah, well, I think this administration, Scott Turner in particular, they strongly associate welfare with this idea of broken families, single parent households, and this sort of culture of dependency on government assistance. And so I think that's really what they're targeting here.
And I just to paint a picture for people, because the overall numbers you cite in your piece are really horrifying. 4 million people could lose federal housing assistance under these two new rules. And for folks that are unaware, it's like what the average in terms of people's income, average family is making less than $20,000 annually that is reliant on this federal assistance. So to Sam's point about moving, to all of these kinds of points about having a private landlord allowing them to see if you are working and having them come to you and they can evict you based on that.
Assessing your disability.
Yes. I mean, it's horrifying.
You're saying that you're, I don't recognize the college you're going to. I mean, what, like, there's a whole, like, the amount of problems involved in that is, seems stunning to me. And these are all just like, these would all just be civil actions, I guess, on the part of the landlord, right? Or like, to just sue and then have the payments on Section 8 cut off. But I imagine we have an administration that's going to be very open to the idea of it being challenged and maybe even like a default agree with the landlord unless proven otherwise.
Yeah, and I think another thing you could see is you could see states adopting laws that say, you know, if you rent to Section 8 renters or if you're a public housing authority in our state, you have to have work requirements. You have to have term limits. So you could see this sort of being adopted de facto by whole states.
I think you mentioned in your piece about this Georgia's experiment with work requirements for Medicaid recipients. We've talked about it many times in this program, but just retell like the what they found with that experiment.
I'm actually not familiar with that experiment, but I did look a little bit into the research generally on work requirements in welfare programs. And apparently what researchers have primarily found is that they don't really effectively promote employment, but they are very effective at removing people from benefits. So they're good if you're they're good at kicking people off of benefits. They're not terribly effective at, getting people who receive benefits to work more.
Well, all right. I'm sorry. I may have seen that somewhere else, but I'll just remind people that in Georgia, not only did it do the things that you talked about, it also ended up costing an extra like $600 million because apparently like you, there's work to be done to find out if somebody has work. So you need to build that apparatus. Where are we now and how is the government shutdown going to affect things?
I think that, you know, these proposals are probably on ice for the time being. The big news out of HUD yesterday related to the shutdown was there is a massive banner across the HUD webpage that was basically blaming the shutdown on Democrats. I think that something that other federal agencies have been putting out as well, that sort of messaging. But, you know, they talked about introducing these requirements in the last Trump administration. They never got around to it. But I think the fact that they, you know, already have rules drafted this early in the second Trump administration indicates that they're serious about putting this through. And I just want to mention the second rule as well, because we haven't touched on it, which is targeting basically immigrant households receiving federal housing assistance. These are so-called mixed status families in which some members of the household are in the country legally and eligible for assistance and others are not, either because they're undocumented or they have some other immigration status that makes them ineligible for benefits. HUD wants to kick all of those households out of federally assisted housing. So the way it's worked so far is that the government has allowed those people to be supported by federal housing programs, but it prorates the subsidy they receive so that the government is not actually providing any financial assistance to the undocumented family members. But now HUD is saying, no, we want all of those people to leave. And so under this other rule, those 20,000 families would likely be kicked out. 16,000 of those families are families with kids. So that's who this would be affecting. And as part of that rule, HUD also wants to require that anyone who applies for or receives housing assistance, anyone in public housing or Section 8, if they're a citizen, they have to prove it. So they have to either provide a birth certificate or a passport to show that they're actually citizens. And sort of to your point, Sam, earlier about the administrative costs of all this, it's going to create this massive bureaucracy and kind of red tape around housing assistance that experts who I spoke to think is going to result in a lot of people just being kicked off of their benefits simply because they don't have a birth certificate, or they don't have time to go get one or whatever, or it's going to create these massive administrative overhead costs for these public housing authorities who suddenly, you know, are like the passport checkers of the whole federal housing program. So that's the other rule that's also in the works right now.
And this is all in the shadow of the Faircloth Amendment, which I still think does not get enough attention. The idea that we have had a cap on the construction of federal public housing since 1998 or 1999 or whatever, since it's been passed, like, these are it's already a threadbare system, whether it's public housing or, you know, Section 8 or what you're talking about, or the subsidization for some of these other privately held units and living spaces. We there's just not enough public housing as there is, let alone what we're seeing in terms of them trying to kick people out based on racist and xenophobic ends explicitly with the immigration piece.
Yeah, and I think what's worth noting here as well is what its overall picture for housing is. I mean, if you look at the Trump budget proposal, they want to cut public housing, Section 8, these rental assistance programs by like nearly 50%. They want to turn these programs into block grants, basically just hand them over to the states and say, you deal with it. So, you know, their ambition is to dramatically curtail the federal government's efforts to help poor people afford housing.
And just to be clear, if I am a single mother of two. My children were born here in the United States. They are American citizens because we still have birthright citizenship in this country. I am undocumented, or my visa has expired, or I am still, at this point, people are getting deported even if they have documents and are in the process of applying for citizenship or applying for a green card or applying for any other type of visa. So I don't even want to say undocumented necessarily. The federal government gives me not three portions essentially of Section 8 funding, but two for the three of us. So we either have to live in a smaller apartment than would be called for an individual with two kids, or we subsidize it in some fashion. Everybody gets kicked out under this Trump proposal. These kids are essentially made unhoused.
That's right. And what's interesting about that is because the government isn't subsidizing everyone in those households actually pay more. And so by enacting this proposal of kicking out all the immigrant mixed households and replacing them with fully eligible households, it's going to cost the federal government like an additional hundreds of millions of dollars every year to provide federal housing assistance. So, you know, for a government that is reportedly obsessed with cutting costs, this is actually going to dramatically increase costs for this administration.
Yeah, I mean, this is really just a way of cutting out this program and using, again, immigrants as the sort of like a selling tool. I mean, we're seeing this right now with the whole government shutdown.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly of a piece with, you know, everything the administration is doing, you know, on the issue of immigration, and, you know, and everything the administration has been doing in the housing space on immigration. I mean, HUD and DHS in March announced a data sharing agreement targeting mixed status households. Recently, the Washington Examiner, the right-wing news outlet, reported based on HUD sourcing, apparently, that HUD wants to demand that every public housing authority, there's like 3,000 of them across the country, identify all of the mixed households to it. So, you know, there's been this sort of broad effort to identify all these families and so that it can kick them out.
Do we know if ICE has been sort of like ramping up its enforcement using the data they're getting from HUD?
I looked into that a few months ago and spoke to public housing authorities across the country, and none of them really describe any uptick in ICE activity, you know, at their, you know, housing estates. I think it's maybe more of a practical issue than an ideological one. You know, these mixed families are kind of scattered across the country. I mean, most of them are in California, Texas, and New York, but, you know, within New York, you know, they might, there might be a handful here, a handful there. And so it's not really as efficient as, you know, posting up at immigration court, for example, where you know that people who are coming through right. are going to, you know, potentially have, you know, immigration issues. There's also an issue of, you know, if you're trying to enter someone's private apartment, they technically need to give you permission in order for you to be able to enter unless you have a certain type of warrant. So it's much easier to nab undocumented people in public space, which is why I think we haven't seen large scale raids in public housing yet.
Jesse Coburn, reporter at ProPublica, covering housing, transportation, cities, and infrastructure. We're going to link to your pieces on this HUD memo, and really appreciate your time today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks so much.
All right, folks, quick break. When we come back, Antonio Delgado, Lieutenant Governor of New York State, is also a candidate for governor in the 2026 Democratic gubernatorial primary. We'll be right back after this. We are back, Sam Seder, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Antonio Delgado. He's the current Lieutenant Governor of New York State and also a candidate in the Democratic gubernatorial primary in 2026. Lieutenant Governor, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here with you.
It's pretty, it's not typical to see a lieutenant governor running against a sitting governor. In fact, Hochul was the one, I believe, appointed you at one point when she became governor. Give us a sense of why you made this decision.
Status quo is broken. It's not working for people every single day. Every day New Yorkers are being left behind. And what I have learned is absent bold, decisive, transformational change in this moment, we're not going to be in a position to restore people's confidence in this thing we call democracy. Just as a point of reference, in New York, 1 out of 4 folks are unable to afford basic necessities, basic needs. 1 out of 4, 2 out of 5 households cannot afford basic necessities across the state, whether it's upstate, downstate, urban, rural, doesn't make a difference. People are being left behind. 1 in 5 kids in poverty, half those kids in deep poverty. And oh, by the way, a $254 billion budget right here in New York, third largest economy in the country, if an independent nation, the 9th in the entire world. Meanwhile, the largest wealth inequality gap of any state in the country. So here we are, the great blue state of New York, and we're exacerbating economic inequality, which in my estimation is the poison pill of democracy. So until we actually right-size this and move beyond the old guard, establishment, broken system, machine politicians, we're not going to be able to fix this.
Expand on that notion of wealth inequality, because that's something that we tend to talk about quite a bit around here. How does it end up breaking down democracy and also the sort of the material condition of people?
Well, when I was growing up, so I grew up in Schenectady, working class family. My parents worked for General Electric back when GE had a major presence in upstate New York. I cut coupons, put clothes on, lay away, latchkey kid, come home, you know, do my homework, leave it on the counter. I watched my parents work us up into the middle class. And I actually believed, and my parents did too, that I had a better than 50-50 chance of having a better quality of life. That story of upward mobility is essential to any growing sense of confidence in democracy, this idea of equal opportunity for all. Since my generation, I'm Gen X, since my generation, the folks coming up behind us actually are going to do worse off. Right now, the average first-time homeowner age is around 40. 20 years ago, it was 28. The average rent right now is 7 times income. 30, 40 years ago, it was 3 times. So even just the price of admission into opportunity on the part of the generation coming up behind us is too high to engage. And so if you're being priced out of the project of democracy, why even believe in it in the first place, right? Why do you actually decide to hold on to it if it's not giving you anything in return? So there's a sense of economic nihilism that sets in that is pervasive across race, across geography now. And I think it's fundamentally undermining our democratic system. 2/3 of folks right now can't pay, are actually living paycheck to paycheck. You know, they literally cannot survive right now beyond what's literally coming into them on a weekly basis in the richest country the world has ever known. And meanwhile, corporations are making more money than they've ever made and paying less in taxes. Those two things shouldn't go together. So yes, it is a profound sense of undermining when it comes to the very essence of what a democracy is meant to do, and that is to not leave communities behind. But in fact, we have government actors on both sides of the aisle right now who are reinforcing economic inequality at the expense of everyday New Yorkers and everyday Americans.
And I think that it was kind of a fatal flaw in the 2024 Harris campaign with the focus on democracy, where it's how are you going to get people to buy into a system that has not been working for them? And there was not requisite acknowledgement of that, which it seems like your campaign is trying to correct. And I found it interesting, you know, you have a different approach to housing, which is arguably the biggest issue for New Yorkers, one of the biggest issues in the country. And you have a difference in strategy than Governor Hochul here, more focused on subsidies. What is your housing proposal for New York State, and how does it differentiate from the current governor?
I appreciate that. The housing crisis is fundamental. And the strategy, and not just here in New York, I argue across, you know, the country with regards to democratic politics, is to leverage the private marketplace, and in particular, big developers with tax credits, with the hopes that they ultimately build affordable housing. And essentially, you outsource all of the state's capacity, both administratively, technically speaking, and you just say, please, private sector, with all your infinite wisdom, devise for us affordable housing, when we know the driving mechanism for those private actors is profit. So here we are trying to work out a public good in partnership with the private sector, but the private sector has all the leverage because the private sector then uses its money to compromise political actors to give them what they want in exchange for what's called affordable housing. Why not build up our own state capacity, leverage the public dollars that we have, and then have statewide programs that give money directly to New Yorkers? So for example, a statewide rental assistance program. Right now we have 7 out of 10 New Yorkers who are eligible for HUD rental assistance. And right now our governor has proposed a $50 million pilot program. I would suggest a $250 million statewide program that lifts up all folks who are in need. Or how about a statewide first-time homeowner grant program? So that all those young families who are being priced out of the economy, priced out of the American dream, can actually have public dollars reinforce them at a time of real critical need. That to me is the difference. It's taking public dollars and investing them directly in public goods, as opposed to taking public dollars and hoping through the lens of neoliberalism that the private sector and the free market will somehow work it all out for everybody else. That's just a more sophisticated version of trickle-down economics, if you ask me.
Let's talk about universal health care. What does that mean when the rubber meets the road in the context of, A, what you can do in New York State as opposed to on a federal level, and B, what it means relative to the question of affordability? You know, how much health care insurance or actual health care are you talking about providing versus making it broadly affordable?
I support the New York Health Act, which would create a single payer system right here in New York. The thing that that drives me wild, crazy about healthcare is this idea that we're not paying for healthcare. We're paying for insurance. We're paying for companies to basically extract as much profit as they possibly can at our expense. And that is basically the entirety of our system. And the notion that we're going to continue to allow folks to go bankrupt, continue to be denied over and over and over again, continue to have to go through God knows how many obstacles just to appeal a denial is insane when we are literally in the richest country the world has ever known. And on top of that, one of the richest states. We have the capacity here to actually sustain ourselves, and the cost savings upwards of $60 billion annually once you get beyond the insurance a company's bureaucracy, middlemen, infrastructure, red tape, and of course the profiteering mentality, you get beyond all those components and the savings actually start pouring in. And ultimately, it's a moral question too. Who are we as a nation if we're not prepared to treat healthcare as a genuine human right? So both morally, economically, and I would say even politically now, where we have an actor right now in Washington who is dead set on gutting healthcare, gutting Medicaid, gutting the entire social safety net. New York has a responsibility to lead in this moment. We have the wherewithal. We are the financial capital of the world. We have among the most billionaires, the most millionaires. We have the capacity to lead in this moment and demonstrate for all of America what it means to actually not leave anybody behind.
Give us a sense of, like, you know, how you're going to do this, both as an electoral question, but also in terms of like the coalitions, right? I mean, there's big money in New York. New York is a very, very diverse state. You were a congressperson in between the 18th and the 19th, which used to be the old 19th and 20th.
Yes.
That district, the 20th in particular, which is just a little bit north of where you were the congressman, was a very sort of like a pivotal district. Gillibrand served there, go either way, as we've seen. And at one point there was like the Congressman Sweeney, who was in the...
Let me clarify one thing, because I just want to be clear. Just so, because I'll make sure the listener knows, the district that you're referring to is actually redrawn in 2010.
Yes.
And then I ran 8 years later in 2018. When it was drawn in 2010, no Democrat, including Gillibrand, no Democrat had ever won the district as drawn in 2010. It was a 90% white district. It was the eighth most rural congressional seat in the entire country. Obama did win the 19th in 2008. Trump, though, won the district in 2016 by 7 points. And at that point, no Democrat had ever won the district. So when I ran and we flipped that seat, I became the first person of color to represent upstate New York in Congress, the first Democrat to actually represent the district. And then we won it again in 2020 by 12 points. And I outperformed Biden by 10 and won in counties that Trump himself won at the same time in 2020. And so to take your question where I think it's going, we can build a coalition here that is rooted in a populist message that speaks to the economic pain that our small family-owned farms, over 5,000 were in my old district, the 27,000 small businesses on those mom and pop stores across those main streets in those rural areas that I saw decimated both prior to COVID and during COVID, who are being left behind by the concentration of power and monopolies. We have an opportunity to connect that pain to every other New Yorker in the Bronx and Manhattan, to the Teamster truck driver, to the young family or the young mother who's trying to work a job in a factory or somebody's working in a bodega, we have the ability to connect all this economic pain across race and across location in this state in a way that I don't think has happened in a very, very long time. And it's been long, long overdue. And that is how you build a coalition. That's why I was proud to get the endorsement of Citizen Action, a people power grassroots campaign. I don't take corporate PAC money. I take people's resources, the people's desire to want to fight for something deeper than what we currently have. Governor Hochul, she does take corporate PAC money. She's entrenched in corporate power. There's a key distinction here. And I think there's a real appetite for having the kind of candidates in government who can work beyond concentrated corporate power and tie their mission to the people's mission.
Give us a sense of one of the things that may be on the plate of the next governor is working with the potential new mayor in Zohran Mamdani, knock on wood. Give me your perspective towards this, because when Mamdani was first won the primary, and I think maybe prior to that, Hochul seemed to be rather cynical about his opportunity to implement agendas that he's been talking about implementing in the city, which, you know, frankly, are not particularly anything that we haven't seen maybe in Massachusetts or in Georgia. I mean, most of those ideas have all been implemented in one place or another. What's your perspective on the potential of working with Zohran Mamdani?
I endorsed Mamdani within the first 24 hours of his victory. One, he's the Democratic nominee. And I think it speaks volumes that so-called leaders of the Democratic Party wouldn't rally around the Democratic nominee. That speaks to a sort of outdated mindset of risk calculus that I think is way behind the times and not remotely what we need right now in this moment. The fact that Governor finally came around to supporting Mamdani months and months later, I think is a testament to the fact of what we're actually building in terms of my campaign and the grassroots movement that is going to continue to put a lot of pressure on her throughout this process. What Mamdani is proposing requires something very important. It requires raising taxes on billionaires. It requires raising taxes on big corporations to fund the programs that he's talking about. The governor may have endorsement 3 months late. She's also, though, refused to say she will raise taxes on billionaires. She will raise taxes on big corporations. And her logic, by the way, is she's afraid that they will move to Palm Beach. Now, last time I checked, the vast majority of folks who are leaving the state of New York make between $30,000 and $60,000 a year because they're being priced out of New York and they're not moving to Palm Beach. So it speaks to who she surrounds herself with, typically the donor class, which is why she's divorced from the reality of everyday New Yorkers. So yes, I'm very excited to work with somebody like Zohran, who understands in this moment that to say you want to address the affordability crisis is not enough. You have to be willing to attack economic inequality if you actually want to address the affordability crisis. You have to be willing to have a desire to say we have to redistribute and reallocate resources in a way that'll lift up all communities. It is not a sustainable endeavor. And the notion that it is a non-starter for her, it speaks volumes, in my opinion.
Lastly, in the event that you become governor, what role does a New York play versus Illinois or a Massachusetts or, you know, I mean, California, obviously, fifth largest economy in the world. What role does it play in terms of a national model in your mind?
I think it's a great question to end on, because that's what keeps me up at night, is what is New York's role right now? You know, obviously the goal is to protect New Yorkers and to fight for all New Yorkers, but this is New York. You know, this is long been the state that has been the beacon of hope for the world over. You know, whether it's our immigrant community, whether it's those who have been fighting the good fight for women's rights, for the suffrage movement, the founding of the NAACP, the labor movement, the LGBTQ plus movement, Stonewall. There's so much that this state has historically been a part of when it comes to progress and living up to our democratic ideals. And there's a reason why I think Trump is so aggressively, despite being a New Yorker himself, I think he understands what New York represents to New Yorkers and to the country and to the world. And we are the tip of the spear when it comes to perfecting our union as a nation, in my estimation. We're also the financial capital of the world, right? So we're resourced, we're multicultural, you know, we're the epicenter of tolerance and compassion, of diversity and equity and inclusion. You know, we are the embodiment of everything Trump is trying to tear down. And it is incumbent upon us to have leadership in this moment that is determined to meet the moment. And that is not a political mindset, to be clear. It's not. It's a moral mindset. If you're not willing to think beyond your self-preservation and your political positioning in this moment, then you shouldn't be in the business of public service. Matter of fact, you probably should have never been, but certainly not in this moment, because Trump is beyond politics. He is a chaos agent. He's a morally bankrupt chaos agent that feeds off of our anxieties, off our fears, and does so in a very destructive, but uninhibited, destructive manner. We need uninhibited love, uninhibited compassion, uninhibited truth that has to go beyond your typical left-right divide. That's how I won in upstate New York, won over Trump voters. And that's how we can win this entire state. But I think New York in particular has a moment to lead. And I don't feel it right now. There's a massive void in one of the biggest, most important stages in this country and in the world. So I think we have an opportunity here to really step up and fight and make it clear to folks that New York is here to defend what we've long represented and to make sure we have a future.
And I know that was a great last question, but I'll just add let me add one more because I didn't want to forget this. In speaking about that, do you have plans, if you are elected governor, to support, say, state divestment from the state of Israel? And do you recognize the notion that it is committing genocide, as the United Nations has basically found?
What I have said, and I've said this repeatedly, you know, whether folks want to call it a genocide or not, what's most important to me is we cannot fund it. And I have publicly said that we should not be arming the destruction of Gaza. We need a permanent ceasefire. We need to make sure there's humanitarian aid that goes directly into Gaza. And we need to make sure that we do not in any way, shape, or form continue and enable the destruction of innocent lives in Gaza. And so we as Americans have a responsibility, in my estimation, a moral responsibility to make sure that we are not putting ourselves in a position where we are enabling this moral abomination.
Antonio Delgado, where can folks get more information if they want to help your campaign in one form or another? Where should people go? Presumably online, but I guess you probably have offices.
Delgado well. For New York, DelgadoForNY.com. Delgado for New York, DelgadoForNY.com. And I will note, since you brought up support, New York has a public matching campaign. First time ever that the state is going to have a statewide elected race where the public will match, the state will match donations 6-1. Any donation between $5 and $250 will get matched 6-1. And we will hopefully become, I will become the first statewide candidate to qualify for public matching dollars, truly making this a people-powered campaign. That is, to me, most important in this endeavor, to make sure that people understand this is a campaign grounded in the will of the people and not a few.
We're going to link to Delgado for New York at majority.fm. Again, Lieutenant Governor, thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much.
All right, folks. That's the that's the show. I found him pretty impressive. It was being a little bit, careful on the last question.
Well, you guys avoided asking the real question.
What was the real question?
Where are the med beds at?
Oh, right.
Oh, yeah. We forgot to ask if you would be in favor of med beds.
Every American will soon receive their own med bed card.
Yeah. I like the at least the supporting, of course, you know, the reality of, you know, not funding it. That's what we can appreciate as well.
I also just want to say, like, you know, I have pretty good knowledge of that district that he came from. And again, the lines of that district between the 18th and 19th and what used to be the 19th and the 20th over the course of the past 20, 25 years have shifted. But that area really does have a real interesting mix of socio and economic and racial mix between Poughkeepsie and Dutchess County, and then across the river. Pat Ryan is now the representative of that district. Not great on things like immigration necessarily, but very good on stuff like on an economic populist vision,
mm-hmm.
and also very good on an awareness of partisanship. You know, at least from congressional standpoint, within the context of New York, that partisanship is really sort of less relevant because the Republican Party is, you know, increasingly irrelevant in this state. And it's really just a fight between corporate would-be Republican Democrats and Democrats who have a, you know, a more populist vision. So
that was awesome.
Was good.
Looking forward to supporting him in the primary.
Yeah, I mean, indeed.
Yeah.
Indeed.
It'll be fun. It's going to be so great to, you know, get closer to the midterms and we see hopefully some of these candidates, I mean, emerging even more and more.
Yeah, it's good stuff.
Hochul's going to need to ride those buses and start talking about congestion pricing a little bit more, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
How she had a huge success with the congestion pricing on temp number four or
We're
whatever it was?
Defend it from Trump. Okay, thanks.
Okay, after stopping it because Hakeem Jeffries was worried that, like, House Democrats being on the front lines. They were, and then it turns out it's just a popular policy that everyone loves and you shouldn't be afraid of it.
I will also say that I appreciate him referring to the so-called Democratic leadership in the state.
Yeah.
I'm hoping we get a very good candidate against Hakeem Jeffries. We'll see. All right, we're going to take a break. Head into the fun half of the program, wherein Emma will find out that Big Balls apparently was in her replies yesterday on X, according to Emma.
He probably is still mad about after when he supposedly allegedly got beat up in D.C. I tweeted, not so big balls, and that made the rounds a little bit. Maybe.
Hey, my balls are big.
Yeah, monitoring me for
balls
hate
in their hands
now.
Who?
Yeah. I wish I cared more.
Anyway, I thought that was Steve Bannon's burner account.
Oh, right. Yes. Yeah, Neera Tanden's mad at me.
Well, that guy doesn't get many views. It was only 267 views on his...
Is it the real guy?
I don't know.
Maybe I'm going to trust my friends in the government.
Folks, just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. And you can go to jointhemajorityreport.com.
We don't have to discuss it.
jointhemajorityreport.com, wherein you can help this show survive and thrive. Not only that, you get the free show free of commercials. And you get to IM us on the fun half and be the first one to let Emma know that Big Balls has replied to her. Also, don't forget justcoffee.coop fair trade. coffee and hot chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY to get 10% off.
Matt?
Yeah, last night Left Reckon, who we are 250 subscribers now, short of 50K.
Come
YouTube.
On, people!
Damn, you got like 200 from that push yesterday?
I did, yeah. It was a good push.
She
I got
keeps
start,
scorning.
I got to really like dig those depths more often. we had Gil Duran on talking about Peter Thiel's Antichrist tour.
Nice.
Gil's great on that. And they also had Gwen Howerton talking about the war on trans people in Texas.
We were just about talking about having him.
I was immediately a little disappointed because Matt scooped us, but there you go. Yeah,
we swooped in there and got the big Antichrist scoop. And also we went into on the post game for patrons of Left Reckoning, Ezra Klein's identity crisis, and you know what his role is, and he doesn't know.
So I listened to more of that last night. I just got to say, in the first 15 minutes or 20 minutes, there's this section where Ta-Nehisi Coates talks about like how violence is a constant for Black people in America and how it's cyclical and his experience about it. And Ezra literally says, he says something about how we, if we expand too far in our historical scope, we can't meet the moment. He was, it was the most, I mean, it was the most condescending, dismissive thing I've ever seen about a Black man and an intellectual speaking about the history of racial violence in this country. And Ezra basically hand waves it with a bunch of hot air.
That's like Antonin Scalia saying, like, look, you know, we got to stop with these giveaways to Black people in voting. I mean, come on.
In the part where he said, Ta-Nehisi's like, can you actually say what you think your role is? And Ezra says, I don't know what my role is. I lost my train of thought as I was watching Brian put me up. We'll talk about this in the fun.
Let's talk about it in the fun.
Yeah.
Vain.
Matt was looking too much like, hey, wait a sec.
I got those baby blues.
You're going to put me up for this, Brian?
Have I got to do shoulder work twice a week now? Or what's going on?
Get my lats out.
All right, folks. I'm going to be gone anyways for Thursday. But to those of you who celebrate Good Yontif tonight, it is the holiest night of the year for Jews, and it's even more holy for those of us who come from Massachusetts, because this is the traditional, if you grew up in this way, where you had to go to Kol Nidre services and half the people you knew were wearing transistor radios because the Red Sox are playing in the playoffs. So this is a particular holy night where you Kol Nidre and the night where the Sox sweep. So
catch me wearing forest green at Yankee Stadium sitting behind first base tonight.
That's right. Oh. Yes, Brian's going to the game tonight. I'm so jealous.
You made the mistake. You made a prediction where you should not, because that means that this is not.
Emma thinks
not,
you just
destroyed your
yourself.
Chances. You jinxed yourself.
Prediction? I thought you just said it was happening.
Yeah, it's not a prediction. It's happening.
Yeah.
The sweep.
Yeah. Kamala Harris is going to sweep all the swing states. It's totally.
I didn't say that.
Yeah, well.
Every this isn't the Knicks.
It's not the Knicks. It's not the Giants. yes, despite the fact that I am going to celebrate a religious holiday, I don't believe in magic.
Okay, well.
I just believe in the Sox.
Yeah.
All right, we'll see you in the fun after.
3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts. Wait a second. Hold on for a second.
The Majority Report.
Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt.
Who?
What is up, everyone?
Nomi Keen.
You did it.
Let's go, Brandon.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women.
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this 7A?
Yes.
Hi, me? Is this me?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello? Is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
Oh, I'm going to go start watching.
Who libertarians?
They're so stupid, though.
Common sense says, of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him!
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-35-501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion sold. It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less.
But let me say this.
Poop.
Call it satire. Sam goes with satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled,
wow.
Folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock. We're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.
I have a good friend who's a Yankees fan.
Oh, yeah?
He's not pleased.
What'd he say?
You know, the thing is, I was very nice about it, too. I didn't even contact him.
That is very nice.
I am going to his house for the breakfast. So what happens on Yom Kippur is you go to services the night before, or the Jewish holidays start in the evening before it's written in the calendar. And you go and celebrate the Red Sox sweeping. And then the next night you go to the breakfast and see your buddy who you've known almost all your life, who's a Yankees fan. And
I hope that works out for you. I mean, I think you're approaching it. The universe may not reward your arrogance here, but we'll see how it goes.
I mean, listen, you got to enjoy it while it lasts.
I feel like Sox fans are like sort of, given the history, you just sort of enjoy it more than...
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yes.
I wish sports were enjoyable for me these days.
Yeah.
It's just like...
Maybe you reassess your relationship.
I have, honestly. I have. Yeah. And I've had a harder time caring. One, because the Giants are so bad. But two, with the politics, it's like all I think about, which is a little depressing. But I'll find a new hobby. Just, you know.
Meanwhile,
I'm just getting thumbtacks in my neck or something.
I'm just getting, I'm literally getting threats from them now, from the whole family.
Oh.
Yep.
Oh.
About the Red Sox. All right, let's move in. Let's move into, more show stuff.
Do the show.
More show-like
Do
stuff.
The show that we are supposed to do, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Government shutdown. AOC was on Chris Hayes last night talking about the shutdown. And what is, again, there's a subtext to all of this, which is that Donald Trump is breaking all of the rules and the laws around funding the government. Aside from also the more fascistic things or the other fascistic things. That he's doing. And so there is no point in agreeing to a budget and providing some type of veneer of it being legitimate if all of that does is allow the Trump regime to spend in any way they want and to use the money as basically like blackmail. Here is AOC.
There is, over the last week, it seems a lot of people, and I include myself among them, feel like a sort of rising sense of alarm about the aggressiveness of the sort of authoritarian aspirations of this government, firing a U.S. attorney to replace him with a patsy who will indict a political enemy. The you know, the continued threat of using the military on American citizens, the ordering the troops to Portland and then backing up because it was five-year-old B-roll. I don't know. Do you feel the same way over this last week or two? Does it feel like continuity to you? Are there conversations in your caucus about what this last week has meant?
I think there's two things that are happening at once, and this is something that's very important for people to understand. One, there absolutely is an unprecedented abuse of power, destruction of norms, erosion of our government and our democracy in order to prop up an authoritarian style of governance. That is happening. However, they are weaker than they look. And it is important that we remember that, because what they rely on is the impression of power, the perception of inevitability, in us giving up in advance to say, oh, what's going to happen if I stand up, etc. Nothing's going to happen. They rely on that perception of inevitability and power so that people comply in advance and acquiesce in advance and give up in advance. And at the end of the day, Donald Trump is at record levels of unpopularity in his tenure. The Republican House is at record levels of unpopularity. They are underwater across the board, and they know it. And that is causing them to double down in public, but it is backfiring. That is why, whether it's a shutdown, whether it's all of this, they want us to blink first. And we have too much to save. Protecting people is too important a task for us to give up before anything even starts. So they may want to send people in, but these National Guardsmen do not want to be turned against their fellow Americans. We're seeing this here in Washington, D.C. It is an insult. Donald Trump is insulting the service members of this country by putting them on these silly tasks that they themselves do not want to be enforcing. And so we have to understand that standing up matters, that our voice matters, to not give in to the cynicism, because that is what they rely on in order to perpetuate this idea that they are that they have total immunity from consequence. They will experience the consequences of this, but we have to be the consequence, which is why we have to stand tall right now alongside everyday Americans who want us to be standing up right now as well.
Well, so I heard that message of a rallying and unity and a clear-eyed vision of the actual opposition that we face, and as she talks about authoritarianism. But, on the other hand, God is always on the throne. Like, I mean, that is how a leader should be speaking. And I watched that segment last night on Hayes' show. It was really good. She's asked directly about the Schumer primary. I mean, it's basic. The die's already cast here. It's either that or she runs for president or whatever. But it was such a contrast in when you see Schumer just like wandering around in the desert on where he can try to look tough. She has a clear vision of what we face here and what that looks like. And it's about punching them in the nose like they're a shark. If they're coming at you, punch them in the nose. That's how you effectively fight them. You don't try to swim alongside them or, hey, just bite my left arm because I need the right to type. I mean, that's how the Democratic leadership is operating.
In many respects, it was Pritzker being so aggressive that got them to sort of like change their rollout, right? I mean, Chicago was this was the big prize that they've been like priming this pump for years.
Since 2016.
Yes. And they backed down when it was clear that like Pritzker was ready to mobilize his own the Illinois National Guard, and it was just going to get too messy. They cannot deal with any type of significant resistance. I mean, that's why, you know, Trump is betting that the Democrats are going to cave in this instance, and I wouldn't be terribly surprised if over time that was the case, but at the very least, just even putting up some measure of fight. It's not about necessarily even winning these fights at this point because things are stacked. But it is putting up enough of a fight that indicates like there is a fight to be had. You do not give up beforehand. Yes, yeah. Exactly.
I mean, it's a way it brings so Trump has effectiveness and overperforms in presidential elections versus, say, the midterms where Democrats overperform because he knows that he has to be constantly in the news and is driving the news coverage. What crazy thing is he going to say next? For the sane part of the country, a majority, that gives us an immense amount of anxiety on a daily basis if you're paying attention. But for his base, at least they like it. How do you draw attention to what you're trying to do politically? And the shutdown is a way to do that. Like, people aren't paying attention to Congress on a day-to-day basis. If you have a shutdown, then this is an opportunity for Democratic leadership to say, this is why there's a shutdown.
Yep.
We can't agree on this. They are trying to throw over like 12 million people off of their health care coverage, up to 17 or whatever. I think that might be the Medicaid numbers.
Well, here's yeah. Representative Brendan Boyle from Pennsylvania. He is on he was on MSNBC yesterday with Lawrence O'Donnell, just walking through what folks in Mike Johnson's district are going to see in terms of loss of health care and increased cost for those who don't lose it.
One of the examples you've put out is in Speaker Mike Johnson's Louisiana district, a 60-year-old couple earning $82,000 a year, their health care premiums will rise by almost $20,000, by 300% because of what their congressman is doing.
Yeah, ironically, Mike Johnson has one of the largest Medicaid populations of any district nationwide. But I do want to stress that yes, this is dramatic and will be awful if you're on Medicaid, will be awful if you're on one of the Obamacare exchanges, will be awful if you're on Medicare, but it's actually the health care of all of us, regardless of how you obtain it, because even for those of us who might not be on one of those programs I just mentioned, premiums are set to rise and by a dramatic amount, literally beginning in a matter of hours. So that is what is at stake. That is why we have a sense of urgency. That is why we can't wait 3 months or 6 months or 9 months. This is a fight for right here, right now. And truly, this is the last best opportunity for us to stop these dramatic changes to our health care from taking effect.
All that's happening in Mike Johnson's district, I don't think it's going to end up those people that are going to be most targeted by these health care cuts were probably not voting for Mike Johnson in the first place. And the ones that were very excited at the prospect of other people losing their health insurance.
Although I will say that these rural hospital closures are going to be, I mean, it's already beginning, and those are very wide in terms of landmass districts, but having less population. And that's where those impacts are really going to be felt, because over half of rural hospitals are now at risk of closure due to the big, ugly bill. And those people are going to be affected, but they're so gerrymandered and concentrated. These districts are like R plus 30 or R plus 25 or whatever, that Republicans, their concept of public services, I can stay in power and still immiserate the people in my district anyway, because it's so deep red.
We should probably also address the rumors about Mike Johnson and Grindr. They're just rumors. And so, you know, people are asking, like, why don't you talk about it? Because they're just rumors. There's supposedly someone who has info that they sent to Politifact. Yes. And there's supposedly like a picture of, you know, that they have of a screen grab of Johnson before he was speaker. That's a rumor.
Just a rumor.
So ask the moms.
We're not going to, you know, go into that. If there's some information that comes out that substantiates it more, we know that his son monitors his phone use. So, I mean, I know people are like, that's weird. Why would you even tell people that, as if like you were building some type of alibi beforehand?
Yeah.
But
it's not weird.
We're not in that business.
He
so
monitors his son too. They're keeping each other accountable.
Right. Okay. That makes more sense.
No reason to validate those nasty rumors that he's all over Grindr.
Just getting an IM that comms just went down on the lead flotilla boat as they neared the Israeli blockade.
It appears that, so their camera went down and looks like Israel is going to intercept the flotilla. A reminder that Israel, legally, this is in international waters, but they have been asserting their jurisdiction over this every time these flotillas have tried. So I think Samud is being intercepted right now.
And of course, if you're Israel, it makes total sense that you would not want any small amount of aid to reach the starving people that you are constantly bombing and killing. Because then they'd get aid.
Well, it's not. And also what's I think even more horrifying for Israel is the precedent that this sets, especially that you have European ships that are at some points in the flotilla's journey have accompanied them, because whatever happens here, I don't think Greta, I don't think the other activists are going to stop. But Israel has been escalating their threats against them. We didn't fully cover this, but for example, just some of the weird things they did, they like took over their radio system and started blasting ABBA in the middle of the night because they're obsessed with Greta Thunberg and the fact that she's Swedish. So they think that's hilarious.
Fixated on race, that's weird.
Yeah, that's
it's not
odd.
Like ABBA's that bad. I actually enjoyed ABBA back in the day.
But it's whatever.
Not a good joke either.
It's they're Israelis. I mean, they don't like they're not funny.
Israeli comedy.
Yeah. I mean, well, right.
Did you ever see any of those clips of their Israeli Saturday Night Live thing?
Yes.
No.
It looks like a parody of what it is. And I think Dave Rubin was on it.
Oh,
is that possible? That was part of. There is that report too about influencers getting $7,000 a post. I wonder.
Yes, Quincy Institute has two big, or like I think they're really interesting. Responsible Statecraft has two articles that came out in the past few days. One is about the new TikTok investors, deep Zionism. And connection to the Israeli government. And then the other is about how Israel is basically paying, according to documents that Responsible Statecraft got, 14 to 18 TikTok and Instagram influencers $7,000 per post.
It's not enough.
I mean, and I know everyone's seen these kinds of posts, right? There are people.
I'll find one.
You have. I know you sent it in the Slack. It's just kind of. It's relevant, Matt.
This
if you
one
have
with
it.
The two influences. Yes. Yeah. Okay. Let me
see. Don't know if these are the people that.
This is unbelievable.
That Responsible Statecraft is reporting on. These
are
just.
We don't know the names, right?
No, we don't know if.
Yeah, we should probably.
All right. All right. Well, I mean, they're horrible regardless, yeah. but people can find it, and you know what we're referring to about like these influencers, so.
I don't know who the people are. I don't both know who specifically the influencers are that are being paid, because we don't know that information. And I didn't know who those two people were.
I don't know either. They're just like rage bait, basically.
Oh.
They shouldn't be doing it for free if they are.
Right. It feels, and I just keep bringing it back to this, but Benjamin Netanyahu met with Dave Rubin, Tim Pool, and other
Under Chatham House rules
influencers earlier this year. If they're doing this with TikTokers, $7,000 a month, do you think they explored financing right-wing shows? Just throwing that out there, because we know that Tim Pool took money from Edward Gregorian, but that's dried up now because
has
that was a Russian
has Tim Pool said definitively that he is not receiving payments from any outfit that is doing so on behalf of Israel. What was it? What was it? The LLC that they were doing it through? I mean, I think I will say this unequivocally. We do not get paid by anybody other than the advertisers that we actually read the advertisements for. Our members, or the advertisements that run on YouTube, and then I guess we get also the Twitch Prime things. But all of the sources of our income are completely transparent, except for the fact that, like, you don't know the name of the members. Outside of that,
neither do we.
Right, and also,
but I want to thank them very much, each and every one.
Right, right. But the members aren't also reaching out and being like, "I will cancel my very lucrative membership if you don't do X, Y,
and
Z."
Sign this NDA.
And if they did do that, they've made demands of us in the IMs. Sam, you will literally kick them off the show often if they're being a little bit too rude about it.
It works easier on email because then I can, know I'll fire them.
Yep.
I wonder if Tim has said that, because it's curious. But Tim has moved on, at least the moment. Let's talk about this. It is being widely reported that at least the first ship of 11 people that we summarily executed as a country in the Caribbean Sea, as they were traveling from Venezuela to Trinidad. And then I think they were actually, once they realized, like, they're being tailed by a drone, they tried to turn back to Venezuela. It is being reported that those people now in Venezuela were just merely fishermen. And which makes sense, because 11 people on a boat running drugs of that size does not make sense, because
you're wasting gas.
You want it to be the drugs.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, here is Tim Pool sort of walking that fine line. Remember, Tim wants to both pretend he's sort of libertarian, sort of anti-war, but also pro-Trump, and
against the pro-Palestine protesters.
He needs to walk a line.
It's quite a monkey's paw.
One guy.
Here he is. Matt was engaging in his classic. Can only listen to
3.7 times.
That was actually
Matt.
Tim Pool in 0.75.
I can't be watching that at normal speed. Okay, life is too short.
Fall draft in 9 years. I don't want to be involved in a war overseas. We got enough problems with these narco gangs coming out of Venezuela and South America, bringing drugs through our border, child trafficking, all this really nasty stuff. And you know what should be happening? Venezuela should be saying, stop. These guys who are getting up on these boats with drugs should be like, I ain't doing that. Are you crazy? And that's what we are getting with a real Department of War. I got to tell you, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, we get, what was it? Collateral Murder was the name of the video put up by WikiLeaks. And I'm wondering why it is there is a video at all of, I think it was like, what, it was like Apache or something, a helicopter strike on a bunch of guys, including a Reuters journalist. And it was this big scandal. Whoopsie. Why?
Wait, what?
Why is that the news that we're getting?
Hold on.
Why was that the news? It was leaked by Chelsea Manning, and she was in jail for years because of that specific video.
We had confused them.
Does he not know what? Does he think it was accidentally leaked by the U.S. government?
He does this weird thing where he tries to play both sides, but like that was an example where the president was a liberal, and the liberals were the ones upset about that too.
That was during
Obama.
Well, they were the ones who imprisoned Chelsea Manning for the leak.
Right.
This was
the leak came out under Obama too. Yeah.
And I'm just to self-centeredly point out, he's reappropriating Whoopsie.
I think, or maybe that's just a thing.
No, there's no way. Okay, whatever.
It's just a Mortal Kombat.
I guess. Also, like, how are we getting out of foreign wars by bombing and trying to provoke? Venezuela.
It's just like, he doesn't seem to know the history of that, or he never bothered to. But go ahead.
Okay.
What are we doing over there? Now I get it. You had the Gulf War. You had weapons of mass destruction, whatever the claims were. And I'm just like, what is this? The obsession that the liberal economic order had, the European and U.S. forces with going overseas and nation building. They were trying to
pause.
Incidentally,
it was a conservative Republican president who led us into that war.
And it wasn't liberal economic order nation building. It was the global war on terror.
And what does he think we're doing in Venezuela? We are explicitly saying that that is for regime change purposes. What Trump is doing is bombing a ship. We now know we're fishermen in order to provoke the Venezuelan government to respond so we can wage war or regime change against them.
Is he just unknowledgeable about the history, or is he trying to sort of cram the history in to fit as a premise for what he's about to say?
I think it's hard to answer those questions definitively because I think Tim has two hemispheres of his brain that work independently. The one which is basically anti-war, saying I don't trust the government, and the other that says, like, I'm very proud of what Pete Hegseth and Donald Trump are doing.
As Secretary of War!
Nation building, right? What does that have to do with making the American people live better lives? Now, let me say this. I'm not so stupid or naive to think that with Hegseth and Trump, we won't get similar things. I don't trust any of these guys to a certain degree. I certainly see with Trump and Hegseth, tremendous improvements. Trump has done amazing things working towards peace. They announced the other day this Gaza-Israel peace plan, which I don't trust Israel at all. And there's reports now that Netanyahu's already trying to walk back the agreement, but it won't matter. You're going up against Trump and Hegseth, and these guys...
Wait.
These are not the weak, woke military of
feels
yesterday.
Feels like you trust them.
Yeah. Wait, didn't you just say you don't trust them all the way? But let's not listen to what Benjamin Netanyahu said about not abiding by the ceasefire or the fact that he already did this earlier in January and just, like, didn't abide by the terms that Trump supposedly negotiated and did this with Biden as well. We just trust the strong men that make Tim feel safe. But I don't trust them all the way.
But I'm proud of what they're doing.
And I love them.
Here he gets to the boat.
So here's what I'm interested in. I see these drone strikes on these narco gangs. And the first thing I think is, let's be honest. Are we going to trust the government? If you want to trust the government, I got a bridge to sell you. I'll tell you what. Luke Rutkowski wearing his shirt the other day. Trust God, not government. However, there's something really funny here. When I see a story about Barack Obama blowing up kids or whatever, you know, there's interestingly, coming from the liberal press, I have to wonder, like, wow, they're willing to say that about Obama. Yeah. But there's a question. Why? Why did Barack Obama order a drone strike on a civilian restaurant in Yemen, which killed a 16-year-old American citizen? Honest question. I'd like answers to that, please. Reportedly, Donald Trump ordered a commando raid.
We've talked about this. It was Anwar al-Awlaki's son, and it was wrong. I mean, they shouldn't have killed Anwar al-Awlaki either. The Obama administration found essentially on their own through the OLC that they had the authority to kill American citizens if they were engaged in inciting terrorism, as they claimed Anwar al-Awlaki did. His 16-year-old son was killed, I don't know if it was like 2 months later or 3 months later. And the only response that ever came from the White House was the guy went on, I think, to work for Uber. I can't remember which one, who said, well, he had a bad dad.
Oh, Malcolm Nance.
No, it wasn't Malcolm Nance. Malcolm Nance we had on this program, but it was one of...
Gibbs?
Gibbs.
Yeah.
I think it was Gibbs. And
there were so many Obama people that went to work for Uber.
I know. I don't know if he actually went to work for Uber. Yeah. I can't remember, but that's what he said. We had Malcolm Nance on, and it was the last time we ever had him on, the first and last time we had him on, where he made that claim about al-Awlaki's son had a gun, as if, oh, okay.
Just blow him up then.
But we were critical of that.
So what is? Yes,
yeah.
No,
that's
of course.
The thing is, like, so Tim's saying he doesn't know why we're doing that, but we actually did that for the same flimsy pretext about fighting terrorism that we've done with this.
There's no pretext for the Venezuela thing. It is just like a narco terrorist of people going to Trinidad.
And why is he bringing that up when we have actually like a case of right now, there's a 16-year-old American Palestinian citizen, Mohammed Ibrahim, Jasper Nathaniel's done a really good job reporting and kind of been in communication with his family, being held in Israeli prison that Trump is not basically doing anything to help so far as of what we know. So going back 10 plus years to the Obama administration is a bit odd.
All right. Let's see where he's going with this here.
Honest question. I'd like answers to that, please. Reportedly, Donald Trump ordered a commando raid in Yemen, which they say resulted in the death of an 8-year-old American girl. There's nuance to these stories. Obama's administration admitted it. Whoops, they said. Trump administration, I don't believe, has given a statement. I'm not sure, but this is an allegation not yet proven. I don't care. I'm not playing any games. Why? Now, if the Obama administration wants to admit it, I say, okay, then open a commission and investigate. They're not going to. That was the killing of Abdulrahman al-Awlaki. And to a certain degree, I understand we want to focus on moving forward instead of going back 10 years.
They did claim that they killed him. I don't know. Like, they said that they had authority. I don't understand.
That was a weird thing where Tim had to admit that the Obama administration admitted.
So he's just rolling around and has no idea what he's saying in this situation. Okay, let's keep going. Let's see, get to his point.
They do get to the point around here.
It says it's 8 years and 13 years or whatever. But I ask the question, why? And I know you do, too. Why are we getting stories like this? Then we get the drone strike on the boat in the Gulf. And Trump says in the Caribbean, I think it was, these are narco gangs. These are terrorists shipping drugs and fentanyl or otherwise into the United States. And we aren't playing games anymore. And I say, OK, well, this is different. I know the why now. I understand the why. These people are invading our country illegally with drugs. They're trafficking people. They're killing people. They're putting drugs on our street, which are killing our kids. Enough. Now, there are questions. Do I trust the government, right? They say, I don't know these guys are actually not.
Now, this all could be just a total lie. And on both ends of it, both, they weren't people who were doing that. And the people doing that weren't actually doing that either. But go ahead. It's like it's like watching like a kid play with like G.I. Joe. Yeah. It's like, this is all fictional, but it's also real. And they're going, G.I. Joe's going at each other.
And this G.I. Joe was killed, but he's alive again.
And this is all real, but I don't believe any of it, but it's real.
Okay, there's one final 20 seconds here.
There are questions. Do I trust the government, right? They say, how do we know these guys are actually narco gangs or whatever? Okay. All right. Fair point. Fine. Let's ask that question. But I understand the why in what we're doing. Not that I blindly trust the government, but in this instance, when the U.S. military, when the U.S. government releases these videos, I go, you know, I don't think they're lying on this one. You know, collateral murder, that video was leaked because they didn't want anybody to find out.
All right. This is so convoluted that it's almost like I regret even like the time we spent on it. The collateral damage video was video from Iraq when we were occupying that country in the wake of or on the ongoing war. The assassination of al-Awlaki was done in the name of the global war on terror and a specific authority that the president supposedly had, that Obama claimed, to assassinate people who were not – al-Awlaki had nothing to do with Iraq, but theoretically the why that he so desperately wanted was it's protecting us from terrorism, which is just as flimsy as the Trump administration saying – it's protecting us from terrorism.
Yes. But he has a video of a boat this time.
But this time it's a video of a boat, and the Trump administration was happy to release it. There was no video that we know of al-Awlaki getting killed. It's just he's mashing together all sorts of things that are like, it's G.I. Joe, and it's also John Wayne fighting the Indians, and they're all going together, and the good guys, that's the whole point.
He's confusing Trump's shameless bloodlust and psychopathy with transparency, which is pretty much the MAGA base,
He has he has the stupidest audience.
Probably.
Collected on the
More
internet.
Than Dave?
Yeah, I think so.
I think so, yeah. I think Dave Rubin may be a better, like, stringer of thoughts. I don't know.
Well, I don't know about that.
We don't need to rank, but that was pretty rough. I couldn't. It was hard
it's
to follow.
It's not a competition.
It's not.
That's the important thing to remember. Yeah.
Chocolate and vanilla.
I'm going to try and call in. Oh, wait, did you set up the thing?
We might need to restart.
Come on, come on. I started my computer.
Oh, yeah, you should. This is fine.
I'll look out for it.
Let's see here. Come on. There we go. How come we're getting a little bit of, it's a little bit, like, broken up, like a little digit. Do you hear that, or is that me? The number, ladies and gentlemen, is 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920 is the number. Should we do this Jim Brewer thing just to get it out of the way? Because, sure. You know, the Jimmy Kimmel thing is going to pass, and then we can do a little bit more serious stuff.
What do you mean, should we do this Jim Brewer thing? You've been dying to do the Jim
thing. I've been dying. I know, but now it's like almost getting timed out. This I found really funny. Apparently, Jim Brewer now is not getting booked in the shows that he was getting booked when he had decided that his career was going to be anti-COVID stuff. Too much truth. And to be fair, I've actually watched probably more of his videos than I care to admit. He is skeptical of some things that probably have made it more difficult for his like sort of like his anti-vax crowd.
He recently made a video where he tagged Ron DeSantis in the video and asked him to explain the airplane vapor trails that he.
The point being that. He could be following some narratives that are starting to make some of the more mainstream lunatics uncomfortable. But here he is.
Goat Boy takes on chemtrails.
Also, as well,
how do you think you become Goat Boy?
I mean, honestly, this could be like the last video of Brewers that we could ever really talk about without starting to feel like awkward, if you know what I mean. But here he is. Did you ever see that movie, King of Comedy?
Oh, I love that movie.
Yeah. Of course.
And there's that scene where De Niro is
Pupkin.
Yeah, he's performing stand-up.
His mother's basement.
Yeah,
mother's basement with a recording of laughter and like a picture of an audience. I don't know why that came to me, but here's Jim Brewer. Doing stand up, I think by himself.
Oh,
hold on. Where's the sound?
No sound.
Okay, go back. Oh, and he's talking about Jimmy Kimmel. Now, we should also just say he did this before he was returned to broadcast by the Sinclair Group because they had a kill fee in their contract. Go ahead.
Jimmy Kimmel. I guess he's coming back tonight. Certain places are not going to air him or whatever. You know, I watched some people get all bent out of shape and they were screaming the First Amendment. Okay, well, that is true. But here's the thing, too. He basically said when it comes to letting people in a hospital during COVID.
Pause it for a second. Now, listen, let me be clear. This guy's like the past 4 years, to the extent that he had a revival of some sort, was almost exclusively based upon the First Amendment. And to see him say, well, okay, then just dismiss it. Like, it's been his life's work for the past, like, 3 years.
Bottom
all these truth tellers, and it's like, well, First Amendment, but... And then wait to the joke that apparently Jim Brewer has been, like, nurturing in like a like 4 years,
5 years,
5 years that Jimmy Kimmel delivered, that according to Jim Brewer makes Kimmel like He doesn't even get the first.
I'll just point out the song he's using in this is the song that was used in the 28 Days Later trailer by Godspeed You Black Emperor.
Well, because all the Vax people are zombies, yes.
Okay. Thing two, he basically said, when it comes to letting people in a hospital during COVID,
the number of new cases is up more than 300%. From a year ago. Dr. Fauci said that if hospitals get any more overcrowded, they're going to have to make some very tough choices about who gets an ICU bed. That choice doesn't seem so tough to make. Vaccinated person having a heart attack? Yes, come right on in. We'll take care of you. Unvaccinated guy who gobbled horse goo? Rest in peace, Wheezy.
Now, yes, we can argue that's the First Amendment, but I think there's repercussions when you're that hateful towards other humans. And just because you're paid really well to sell hate, some of us would put morals in front of that price tag. Some of us.
Pause it. Okay, and I'm like going like, okay, this is sort of like a little bit crazy, but when I was watching this, like somebody sent this, and I'm like, okay, that's a little crazy, but I like how he's building to a crescendo, and he's just going to make this about morals. Okay, it's not about First Amendment anymore. It's about morals. And if you're going to be on a late night show, you can't make jokes
right
about people who refuse to vaccinate.
We like our ivermectin,
okay,
sir.
Yeah, excuse me.
Right.
Spirit.
That's morals. And you can hear the music crescending. And I'm like, wow, this guy's sort of changed his style. He's no longer has to act like a moron to sell his point. And it turns out, on my face.
Really well to sell hate. Some of us would put morals in front of that price tag. Some of us. Some of us will go, I'll take the money. What do I got to say? Hey, if you're not vaccinated, go eat some horse goo, Wheezy. He's so brilliant. He's on our side. He's smart. He listens to the scientists. He listens to the specialists. He must be right. He's on television. Quack, quack.
Jim, quiet down. I'm trying to watch my programs up here.
No noise complaint.
Jimmy, stop podcasting in the basement. The lasagna's ready.
Now I gotta redo it!
I listen to the scientists.
I don't get why he was making the wheezing noise. It didn't.
Also,
he's making fun. It's just like total association. He said the joke about wheezing people, so I will make the wheezing noise.
But it seemed like he was trying to transition to.
Yeah, my God.
Honestly, I laughed out loud when he immediately went into he just got the point. Like, people need to have morals. Oh, my God.
Oh, my God.
See?
You did miss a chance to do a horse. The horse goo.
Well, that's true. That's true.
I don't know if that's in his wheelhouse or barn, for that matter.
Oh, my gosh.
He did the 28 Days Later soundtrack to make it sound like he was transitioning to serious comedian pundit, but he couldn't help himself.
And it turned out like the virus was in his own brain.
The thing is like, we're like just starting to cross into like Joker territory. Like, it's like he's doing sort of like these goofy characters, but they're getting like just darker and darker. Oh boy. Calling from an 845 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from? 845.
Hey, it's Ben from Queens.
Ben from Queens, what's on your mind?
So I wanted to respond, actually, to the caller from yesterday, the first caller from yesterday. Because I found their message.
Refresh my memory, please.
The first caller from yesterday was, I thought, a little nihilistic, saying, There needs to be.
Oh, yes. Yeah. We needed an organization. He had a site, I think it was townhallcitizen.com.
And so I want to address, like, I agree that our problems can seem very large and insurmountable. But I think if you look at organizations in your area, like, I want all the listeners and viewers to think, like, what do you care about? Because, for example, I care about childcare. I have two children. So I'm a parent leader with New Yorkers United for Childcare. That's right now where I focus my energy, where I can make an improvement in my life and the life of those around me. And it goes towards, like, Zoran Mamdani's other, it's one of his platforms, Universal Childcare.
Right.
So I want the, sorry.
No, I said right.
So I implore listeners and viewers, like, focus on a small issue and see if there's some, if you can join an organization addressing that issue. And if that organization doesn't exist, maybe you can start it.
Yes, and I will say that the second and third order value of what you're doing is, you know, obviously the first order is you're advocating for that change that you want to see and that solution for your problem. But you're also building relationships that if there is a larger issue or one that is outside of that purview, I should say, you have relationships and if not an organization that can also start to branch out in other areas. It may not, or it may. It can develop leaders who may end up like joining another organization and becoming, I mean, that is the way that it ultimately works. The idea that like people without any type of organizational structure are going to be able to rise up and A, it's unlikely that you're going to be able to achieve anything without any type of organizational structure. B, without that organizational structure, in the event that you do come to power, you are very, very susceptible to going sideways because you don't know necessarily, like, there's no rudder.
Right. And community, I would say, in the form you're talking about, but if it's, it can be community in a variety of different ways, but when you're trying to channel it politically, it is the best antidote to fascism in many ways. I mean, AOC was saying it on Hayes about not being despondent and how the fascists win as if they, you know, people are scared into submission and aren't willing to engage anymore. But part of why the Christian fundamentalists in this country are so obsessed with gutting the state capacity to provide for people is they want there to be no sense of community or no outlet for community other than the church, and then get back to work and work for a capitalist, basically. So there's a threat in having community connection in a variety of different contexts. That's also why they're so scared of cities, because it's a bunch of different people from all of, you know, different walks of life interacting with one another and learning from each other's experiences. It is a powerful antidote.
And I would just like to say, I think the thing I reacted most negatively to was that the idea that all these organizations are useless. That's not that wasn't a proper reading of Jane McAlevey, who in fact worked with DSA. And has a discussion of no shortcuts here. Some of these links are broken, but the second one, you can watch these video calls. But you need to be taking part. First, it needs to be labor-oriented, which Jane McAlevey also says. The strike, labor strikes are the real way to fight fascism. Community groups, broadly speaking, that aren't around organizing workplaces are very important, but you really need the labor element of that. But also, short of that, you need to join a group like Indivisible or DSA to start putting her teachings in place. It isn't the case where you put up a list of principles and expect people to rally around it. That's just not how politics works.
Appreciate the call. Thanks.
Hey, sorry, one more. Can I do one more really quick thing?
Yeah.
A little while ago, I sent an email to majorityreporters@gmail.com pitching an interview. I'm going to bump it. Even if the answer is no, could you just get back to me so that I can tell my organization if. Thank you so much.
All right. Appreciate the call.
Have a good one.
We'll look for that email. Right. Duber. Yes. The first caller is so right. People should try and get involved in something they're passionate about and changing and try and stick with it and not get pulled in 100 directions. Stay focused and you'll be a more clear communicator and make real change that will help build the connections Sam mentioned. I guess the flotilla now is, this according again to the IM, that it is surrounded by military vessels and is being intercepted as we speak. I don't know if we have any video of that, but no, that just seems to be the report. Oh, do we?
I'm just on their website, the globalsamudaflotilla.org. And I can't tell exactly what's going on, so I don't want to say anything.
All right, well,
Let's get to number 11. There, this is an interesting thing to admit in a debate. It's not terribly inconsistent with the Republican perspective. This is the lieutenant governor race in.
New Jersey.
And I think this is the Republican.
The Republican nominee for governor. This is his lieutenant pick governor. For lieutenant governor.
Okay.
So this is the debate for lieutenant governor.
Now, this is, understand, this is not like in New York. I think they run separately, right? Or in some states they do. In New Jersey, this lieutenant governor is part of the sort of ticket, yeah, as it were, I should say.
The Morris County Sheriff.
And interesting choice for lieutenant governor. And I guess the wonder if, you know, if the top of the ticket agrees with this as well. But interesting pitch.
Taxes are on the table, but I'd be careful of millionaire taxes. They're employing us. They're
so
also
new
employing.
Taxes are on the table in New Jersey in your administration?
Well, you have to look at it. You have to look at the whole thing. But what I'm saying is millionaires, we can't just beat up the millionaires. The millionaires many times are our employers. They're employing us.
Oh, all right.
Weird thing for a sheriff to say, personally.
Yes.
He doesn't have the political tact yet to talk around the obvious truth that, yes, Republicans are representing millionaires and billionaires, too. Yeah,
yeah. But what is, like, the theory here? That they're going to move away?
Yep.
They're going to move away from New Jersey. All the millionaires are going to move away. And then there's going to be no employment because... all the demand for what? So let me just walk through this here for a second. Really rich guy owns a bakery. People come into that bakery. I'm going to buy a pie. I'm going to buy a croissant. I'm going to buy a bagel. I'm going to buy some bread. If that rich guy decides, oh, you're taxing me too much, I'm not going to hire people. And we go there and the line ends up having to be take me an hour. Somebody else is going to open up another bakery, and because there's demand. Like, that's the question. Your business is a function of demand. There is no millionaire who has ever said, I'm not going to expand my business because my profits are being cut into. That's, in fact, the reason why people do expand their business, because they want more profit.
Yeah. And the... Cheryl's campaign better get on this quickly, because as we see voter registration down for Democrats across the country, there was a deeply concerning poll that came out last week showing that she is tied with the Republican in the state of New Jersey. And yeah, there are states like in the Northeast that are obsessed with electing Republicans despite being blue states. And there's, I don't know why that is the case, especially in New England. The money, yeah. But this is not the environment that this should be happening in. The Trump administration is historically unpopular, and Cheryl was the kind of middle-of-the-road pick in that race. Comes from, you know, was my old rep in where I grew up. Wasn't as, like, Josh Gottheimer, who was just, like, Zionist, 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 AIPAC, AIPAC, AIPAC. I'm basically a Republican in everything but the D next to my name. And then there was Ross Baraka, who overperformed but was not able to get over the hump because it was a kind of crowded field. And Cheryl has got to fully embrace a more populist message. And that's a gift to her if she chooses to, because there's no reason that a Republican should win this governor's race in New Jersey. And also, like... what's so funny is that Zohran's model for the corporate tax rate is just over the river, as he always talks about in New Jersey. And there hasn't been the flight that is being described there. So It's a little bit higher than in New York City.
I'm just trying to see if there's live footage from the flotilla.
Drop site seems to be following it.
There is. It's just hard to tell what's going on. Sort of people standing around.
But, I mean, this is real danger that folks... I mean, shout out to... we had Greg Stoker on a few weeks ago from the flotilla. Obviously, Greta, other activists on board. Sending them, you know, a hug through the internet right now because it's very brave and scary what they're doing.
World needs to step up and protect that stuff and stop leaving it to heroic individuals to try to get aid into people being starved in front of our faces.
Yeah. Let's do number 10. What is the name of the person who... Can we play it?
I DM'd the source and they haven't gotten back to me.
All right, well, let's... We can play it tomorrow, I guess. I want to hear back from them. I don't want to get a strike, and it's unclear to me what's... but we're talking about this. There's video of, again, these goons, these ICE goons, masked ICE goons, fascists, who slammed a reporter into another reporter who ended up, like... falling on the ground and landing on his head and had to be taken to the hospital in like a in a neck brace. These guys are just animals. These ICE people are animals, and they should be held to be account. In that in the First Amendment case, yeah, I want to talk about this too, actually. Because this is a really important case. Reagan appointee up in Massachusetts, U.S. District Court Judge, William Young, found that the Trump administration's deportation policies... that were based on ideology. In other words, the biggest examples of that, at least, you know, off the top of my head, Mahmoud Khalil and Öztürk. Is that how we pronounce your name?
Yeah, Öztürk.
Who was the Tufts University student, both of whom were abducted by ICE and threatened with deportation and are still in some respects going through deportation procedures because of what they wrote. Remember, neither one of them are citizens. They were here legally, ostensibly at the discretion of Marco Rubio, who said the State Department could pull anybody's visa for any reason at any time. That may be true, but you can't do it for any reason. You can't do it because of speech. And you can't do it because somebody holds an ideology, regardless of their citizenship status. The judge wrote, "This case, perhaps the most important ever to fall within the jurisdiction of this district court, squarely presents the issue whether non-citizens lawfully present here in the United States actually have the same free speech rights as the rest of us. The court answers this Constitution question unequivocally. Yes, they do." Ronald Reagan nominee. "The court will hold a separate hearing on the relief requested by the plaintiffs. Specifically, the Trump administration stop engaging in ideological deportations." But that premise, or I should say that conclusion, is it's backed by many U.S. Supreme Court cases. But it is also quite obvious. The First Amendment does not bestow rights upon the individual. It curtail those rights exist according to the First Amendment. It curtails the ability of government to do something to these people.
To infringe upon those rights.
Yes, and these are rights that are not granted by their citizenship. There are rights that they have by virtue of being within the jurisdiction of the U.S. government, which is curtailed in its actions. And those actions are, we cannot leverage government largesse, government policy, government force against people based upon something that they say or protest or think or write. That's the point. And a lot of people don't seem to understand. It's the same thing with due process. People, if they are within the jurisdiction of the United States, must be afforded due process, not because they as an individual earn that right by being a citizen, because the government, to protect all the people within the borders of the United States, must have to prove its accusations for everyone to be free from tyranny. That's the point. And so this is good news coming out of that court. The guy also said, just as an aside, was talking about the policy of
ICE.
Of masks.
Oh, masks too, yeah. Right, ICE is masks.
And
is
he,
I have that here if you want
that
it.
Quote that he, yeah, read his quote about, oh yeah, here it is. And here's, and there's the issue of masks. This court has listened carefully to the reasons given by Otsirk's captors for masking up and has heard the same reasons advanced by the defendant Todd Lyons, acting director of ICE. It rejects this testimony as disingenuous, squalid, and dishonorable. ICE goes masked for a single reason, to terrorize Americans into quiescence. Small wonder ICE often seems to need our respected military to guard them as they go about implementing our immigration laws. It should be noted that our troops do not ordinarily wear masks. Can you imagine a masked Marine? It's a matter of honor, and honor still matters. To us, masks are associated with cowardly desperados and the despised Ku Klux Klan. In all our history, we have never tolerated an armed, masked, secret police. And that's...
It was really, really well said. The guy's 85 years old, this Reagan appointee.
Thank God for lifetime judiciary appointments in certain narrow circumstances.
But probably, you know, the kind of FU period of your career for a judge where partisanship, I don't care. I'm going to do what's right here. So good for him. Did you want to play that Rand Paul thing? I mean, it pairs kind of nicely.
Yeah, and
let's do this.
Libertarian Rand Paul.
Just to give like a contrast about how this guy was supposed to be all about the Constitution. We just read that, Sam just read that opinion from the Reagan-appointed judge who actually represented what the Constitution is supposed to curtail the state from doing. And then you have, you know, the libertarian Rand Paul supposedly only listening to what the founders originally intended with his take on the First Amendment.
And let's be clear, there, I don't think there are any more libertarians left. They'll come back when Republicans are out of power, if that's the case. They'll come back and they'll offer their new version. But, you know, Charlie Kirk was a libertarian 5 or 6 years ago, 8 years ago when I debated him at the beginning of the Trump administration. He was a so-called libertarian. He was, you know, going around to TPUSA with gay people trying to sort of sell their libertarian vision of America. We used to debate libertarians on this program all the time. Walter Block was a pillar of the libertarian community, an advisor to Ron Paul. he became a Trumpist and flushed most of that down the toilet. I think it took, I don't know, a couple of months.
Javier
probably.
Malay, I mean, welfare recipient.
Here is Rand Paul, supposed libertarian, supposed with the Constitution.
Supposed.
Looking like Harpo Marx.
Yeah, and now it's just like, well, I'm just a crank.
I was assaulted 6-7 years ago, attacked from behind, had 6 ribs broken and part of my lung
removed,
and still online on a daily basis. People say they wish that it would happen to me all over again. And by sort of making light of what I suffered, they are encouraging other people to do it. And really, that ought to be taken down, and social media ought to be able to take that down. If people are saying this in their workplace, people say, oh, people have a right to
pause it. Incidentally, social media can take that down. They can take that down. When they took down stuff that was a potential danger to people, like denying that COVID exists or denying that the vaccine helped save lives.
Or inciting an insurrection.
When that happened during COVID, Rand Paul was the first person to be out there screaming about the First Amendment. Maybe not the first, but he was certainly there. And so he's, and social media can take it down now. They absolutely can. I'm not even sure that's, frankly,
I've been asked to take stuff down before.
I'm not even like, I think it's perfectly legitimate to make fun of Rand Paul and to make fun of the fact that he's been
beat up
by his neighbor. I do think that explicit calls to violence, I think it's perfectly legitimate for a social media platform to take those down and discourage it. But they can do that right now. His complaint is with social media companies and their terms of service or their lack of moderation. Where was this guy when they were taking down disinformation or threats to Anthony Fauci? And he was complaining about that. Go ahead.
Oh, people have a right to say things. Well, actually, they don't necessarily have a right to say things. Many people have in their contract what we call a moral clause to their contract or a conduct clause. My guess is you have something in your contract that says you have to behave in a certain way. And
when Republicans stop talking about the Constitution and start talking about contracts, you know, you're in a
buddy.
World of hurt.
But what's fascinating here
such
is
a libertarian.
He's talking about, first of all, they refuse to acknowledge that that is coercive, right? Because you don't need to work there.
Right.
Right. That's the whole argument. That is not coercive because you don't need to take that job. You entered freely into that, even though we all know that everybody needs to take a job if they want to pay for themselves or feed their kids or whatnot. But he's now basically comparing an employer to employee relationship with, I don't know, everything else. Go ahead.
Public. Most people do. If you're in the military, you have a conduct code that you have to adhere to in your speech and the way you present yourself to the public. So I think it is time for this to be a crackdown on people. And like I say, it's perfectly legal and legitimate, particularly if it's part of the contract process.
That's right. And you know,
wait, what contract process is he talking about now? Is he saying that people should be fired from their jobs if they
Jimmy
criticize
Kimmel.
Him?
The new terms of services you have to be nice to Republicans about.
Social media.
Hey, look,
Kimmel, I don't know.
There can absolutely be a morals clause. There is, in fact, I would have no doubt that there's a moral clause in Jimmy Kimmel's contract. There is definitely. They did not cite that morals clause. We have the chair of the FCC on record saying to ABC, specifically about Kimmel, we can do this the easy way or we can do this the hard way. That is called not entering into a contract where there's supposed freedom of contract, which is bullshit in and of itself. But even if I was to stipulate that for the sake of Rand Paul's idiocy, this is the FCC threatening get rid of Jimmy Kimmel because of his joke. And I would bet also in that contract, it's pretty explicit where he can go for that joke. And I would also bet they probably saw that joke before it went on air.
Yeah, This is what those libertarians in the past used to call tyranny.
Yeah, exactly. This is why he is such a supporter of the Second Amendment. All right. Two more calls, and then we're out of here.
Got to get to Yankee Stadium.
Oh, yes. I got to go to services.
I'm doing another podcast after this.
347, Erica. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Is this me?
Yes, it is you.
Fantastic. Hi. First time, long time. Big fan of the show. I'm out here in Geauga County, Ohio, which is the county just east of Cleveland, Cuyahoga. Also in Cuyahoga is Lakewood. Lakewood City Council is, we believe, next week proposing putting forth essentially a sanctuary city law to protect trans folks and gender nonconforming folks. They've been having a lot of attendance at their city council meetings by the local Cleveland DSA. And I just wanted to shout that out. The DSA's good hard work on this because, I mean, the council in Lakewood is pretty progressive. Lakewood is kind of known as a progressive city, especially for the area and the state. And I also see in some of the reporting that I've been reading, not a lot of reference to the DSA's work on this and pressure. So I just kind of wanted to give them their laurels on this. As well as the Lakewood City Council, though, for working so hard on this proposal. They sort of presented it at the most recent City Council meeting, and then it went to committee. They essentially voted to send it to committee, and now I believe on the 6th they're supposed to vote on actually passing it, and it's pretty much expected that they will.
Great. Well, shout out to everybody who's been working on that, and thanks for calling in and let us know.
Yeah.
Yeah, bye-bye. The final caller of the day, calling from a 201 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Hi. How convenient. You were talking about New Jersey earlier, because that's where I'm from.
Nice. Which part?
I'm in Gottheimer's district, actually. Mm. Thank you for ripping into him. I hope he fucking gets primaried already.
Northern New Jersey.
Yeah. And, also, it's Chitterelli, or as we call them, Chitterelli. Just correct the
image.
Gosh,
sorry.
This is a real New Jersey call.
Problem. It also segues in what I want to talk about, because, I mean, I don't like Mikey Sherrill, but I hope she wins, because New Jersey is part of the Northeastern Health Collective. I've gotten, like, 2 respiratory infections this month. Finally got my COVID shot a week ago. And, you know, Jack is, and you know, he's an anti-vaxxer, and the reason I'm talking about that is, have you heard of this idea going around called, like, progressive federalism, or I think another one is soft secession? I mean, it seems like with Schumer and Jeffries in control, in charge, in leading the Democrats in the House and the Senate, it seems like congressional politics is kind of a dead end for progressives. And I was wondering if you think it's actually a better avenue to focus on municipal politics or state politics. I mean, you know, Mamdani, for instance, got a start in the state assembly. Also how Pritzker has been resisting against ICE. And I'm wondering if you think maybe it's better for progressives to focus on state assembly positions or city council or governorships rather than Senate and House runs.
Well, I don't think they're mutually exclusive. I appreciate the call. I mean, it's quite clear that for a while, local politics are going to be the only way in which there is like a material benefit given to people. But I think, and certainly the upshot is that out of these local politics will come congresspeople and maybe down the road Senate candidates. But I don't know that they're mutually exclusive. But I definitely think that in the context of, let's say, New York or California, you want to push for the most progressive things because they become models for the rest of the country.
I think it really depends on the state. It depends on the circumstance. I mean, in terms of blue states, as Sam's saying, like, I think there's still a lot of value right now with this energy in primarying Democrats in safe blue states. We unfortunately don't, I feel like, have the same infrastructure around Justice Democrats that we used to. But that's a really easy way to get, I mean, honestly, just like Democratic voters on board when they're not afraid of losing to a Republican and you could just improve within a safe blue district. It's a salient argument at this moment in time.
I mean, you mentioned Schumer and Jeffries. There's a way that which like the corruption is less severe and you might be able to walk into basically an empty party, which is in certain states I've heard people being like, you just show up and you can get like a right. position.
Right.
A couple items and we're out of here. Nassau County spokesperson. Awesome to have Delgado here. Caltech, a strong indicator that Israel is a Zionist project and not a Jewish project is that Israelis aren't funny at all.
I've heard that joke. Point. I've heard that joke before and I almost made it, but I was like, I don't think I can. So thanks, IAMR.
A majority enthusiast. I think this is talking about Ezra Klein. I know what his role is. It's to get the F out of the way. It's simple. Felonious Monk. The importance of joining a community is the fact that you have to choose a lane. The group builds power via anonymity. Uniqueness is rare, but we want others to believe we're alpha thinkers by critiquing others. Lisa Hope. Annual Medicare enrollment begins October 6th. I've already received notices about increased premiums. Dental is $23 a more. Shock and awe incoming in about a week. Oh, I should say this too. Not in the business of giving any type of medical advice. I've been masking on subways this time of year because of supposed spikes in COVID that's going around. And I've started using – there was a study that's in the Journal of American Medical Association in JAMA. If you Google this Azeltine German study, a study of about 450 people, two groups. One was the control getting a placebo. The other one was getting this Azeltine antihistamine 3 to 5 times a day. And they found it pretty effective in inhibiting both like the common cold and COVID as a prophylactic. It's an over-the-counter antihistamine. You can do the rest of your looking yourself, but antihistamine doesn't really have too much of a downside in terms of risk. So, Henry Gold, and it's not going to eliminate your risk at all. Overall, you just get vaccinated and mask, but it's one more thing to use to. Deal with COVID this time of year, particularly as there's going to be a lot of people who are not going to be vaccinated. Henry Gold, now I got to do it. It needs to be clipped. I don't know what that was. Ryan from the Lou. What up, gang? Did Delgado duck the AIPAC money question? Felt like he was ducking, or maybe that's just me.
Not on money. Not on AIPAC money. He's taking small dollar donations, not on AIPAC money. On the genocide part, he didn't, answer
term.
That definitively.
But on funding, he said no.
Yep.
Adam, you guys really need to play the clip of Andy Garcia saying one time to Joey Montana in The Godfather 3. All right, two more. Tequila Willie. Rest in peace, Jane Goodall. Oh, did she pass away?
Oh. That's...
And the final I am of the day, Ralph. Jim Brewer is finally funny. At Brian, Emma, good job today. Go Sox.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the lie.
Shifted it.